Chapter 42. A Miserable Dirty Reptile. After the election, Grant picked up hearsay that he might receive a cabinet post or foreign mission from Garfield, and he eased the president-elect's mind on the subject. "I want no reward further than the approval of the patriotic people of the land." In reply, Garfield expressed disappointment at Grant's reluctance to serve, saying he had hoped to profit from his knowledge of Mexico, Japan, and China, and welcomed his advice on cabinet appointees. Taking Garfield at his word, Grant fruitlessly recommended John Jacob Astor III for Treasury Secretary. In his inaugural address, Garfield seemed to satisfy Grant's expectations, stressing voting rights and economic opportunity for black citizens, and reviving some of the bygone spirit of Reconstruction. Grant's short-lived honeymoon with Garfield ended when he appointed James Blaine as Secretary of State, a man Grant regarded as his political foe. Already he had warned Garfield, "I do not like the man, have no confidence in his friendship nor in his reliability." He thought of yanking support from Garfield, then reconsidered. When he and Julia breakfasted with the new president in Washington, Garfield solicited his advice on policy matters and appointments. Grant huddled with his troika of Conkling, Logan, and Cameron, and kept a weather eye out for their interests. Then came a series of Garfield appointments that infuriated Grant, notably that of Judge William H. Robertson, the man Grant thought engineered his downfall at the Chicago Convention, as collector of the port of New York. It was the biggest plum in the patronage pie, and Grant took umbrage. Having campaigned for Garfield at a torrid pace and helped him carry New York, Grant felt double-crossed. He thought he had earned a special place in Garfield's affections and had been penalized instead. In a published letter, he took a shot across Garfield's bow, alluding to a deep-laid scheme by somebody to punish prominent leaders for being openly friendly to me. I cannot believe that Garfield is the author of this policy. Grant had violated an unspoken rule that presidents not chastise their successors so publicly, and he had done so with unseemly speed. On April 24th, Grant sent Garfield a stinging letter protesting that he had made New York appointments without consulting the state's two senators. To select the most obnoxious man to them in the state is more than a slight. The surly tone Grant adopted suggested he craved a return to power and wasn't ready to withdraw into the political wilderness. He had grown accustomed to exercising power and deeply felt its loss. Once again, he misjudged the revulsion against old-style party bosses. Both New York senators, Conkling and Thomas C. Platt, resigned to protest Garfield's action. By May, Grant described himself as completely disgusted with Garfield's deeds and allowed their feud to play out in the press. On May 15th, Garfield sent a strongly worded letter to Grant, defending Robertson's appointment and saying, "Worthy and competent men should not be excluded from recognition because they opposed your nomination at Chicago." He tempered the note with a friendly ending. "My dear General, I can never forget your great services during the late campaign." Instead of reacting with respectful silence, Grant spewed forth more harsh opinions in public, telling one paper that Garfield is a man without backbone, a man of fine ability but lacking stamina. He pushed things past the point of a rapprochement. Instead of relaxing in the afterglow of his round-the-world trip, Grant fell back into the peevish, crabbed mood of his embattled last days as president, berating Garfield at every turn. As the New York Evening Post observed, the role of the silent man became him much better. On July 2nd, Grant was staying at Fred's cabin in Long Branch, across from the hotel where Garfield's wife, Lucretia, stayed, when word arrived that Garfield had been shot in a Washington train station by Charles Guiteau, a mentally disturbed office seeker. Grant had kept an icy distance from Mrs. Garfield, merely tipping his hat when he passed her. "I do not think he can afford to show feeling in this way," Garfield had complained in his diary. "I am quite certain he injures himself more than he does me." Suddenly, Grant found himself in the uncomfortable position of having vilified a badly wounded president. Almost as soon as Lucretia Garfield learned of the shooting, Grant knocked at her door, entered quietly, and took her hand. According to one observer, Grant was so overcome with emotion he could scarcely speak. Forgetting his spat with Garfield, Grant sought to comfort his wife with a telegram from Washington asserting that the president would survive the shooting, and recounted how many soldiers in wartime recovered from comparable bullet wounds. Grateful for Grant's intervention, Lucretia Garfield later told Julia her husband had been among the first to express sorrow. Grant also wired Secretary of War Robert T. Lincoln, "Express to the president my deep sympathy and hope that he may speedily recover." Lincoln replied that Garfield was perfectly clear in mind and desires me to thank you for your telegram, which I gave to him in substance. The next day, Lincoln plied Grant with rosy telegrams, charting the president's cheerful temper and medical improvements. It turned out that before he had stalked Garfield, Charles Guiteau had stalked Grant. The previous winter, when Grant stayed at the Fifth Avenue Hotel in Manhattan, Guiteau had sent up his card and attempted to visit his room. Fred Grant had warned his father that Guiteau was a sort of lawyer and deadbeat in Chicago. Don't let him come up. If you do, he will bore you to death. Grant couldn't shake the entreaties of this uncouth stranger, who accosted him persistently in the street. Finally, Guiteau trailed a waiter to his hotel room and knocked on his door. Thinking it a servant, Grant said, "Come in." He instantly recognized Guiteau, who looked seedy and like a deadbeat, and reprimanded him. "I said I would not see you." "All I want is your name," Guiteau rejoined. "I don't want you to trouble to write anything at all." "But I don't know you," said Grant with annoyance, "and I won't give you my name for any purpose whatever." A disappointed Guiteau slunk off, only to resurface as the president's assailant. 3 days after Garfield was shot, Grant gave a newspaper interview and commented on Garfield's condition with perhaps more truth than wisdom. At first, he had been hopeful about the president's medical condition, then learned physicians couldn't locate the bullet. "I have known a great many cases of men shot very much in the same way, where the ball was lodged where it could not be found," he said. "The men would rally after the shock and then suddenly change for the worse, contrary to the expectations of the patient and physicians, and then die in a few hours." Realizing his words might depress the nation, not to mention Mrs. Garfield, Grant ended on a more upbeat note. "If the president should live 2 or 3 days longer with his strong constitution and absolutely correct habits, I should expect he would eventually recover." He also said that if he could see the bedridden president, he would gladly board the next train for Washington. Profoundly dispirited by the shooting, Grant argued that it had produced a shock upon the public mind but little less than that produced by the assassination of Mr. Lincoln. He noted that the Constitution made no provision for an incapacitated president, and sensibly suggested that the cabinet should consider a report from physicians about Garfield's disability and, if necessary, deputize the vice president as temporary president. For much of July, as Garfield hung on, Grant felt more sanguine about his recovery, then revised his opinion toward the end of the month. "Now, however, I fear the chances are largely against his recovery," he told Badeau. He applauded a belated decision to evacuate Garfield from the White House in early September and bring him by train to Long Branch. "During the months of August and September, the White House is one of the most unhealthy places in the world," Grant told the press. "He should have been taken from there long ago." Garfield's physician seriously mismanaged the treatment, repeatedly probing the wound without antiseptic conditions, and the president died on September 19th. A shocked Grant received the news at his New York hotel. "You will please excuse me from a consideration of this sad news at this time," he told a reporter. "It comes with terrible force and is unexpected." Withdrawing to a private office, Grant wept such bitter tears that Fred Grant said he had never known him to be so terribly affected. It must have tormented Grant that he would never have a chance to heal the breach with Garfield, and he was probably reminded of the many death threats he himself had received during his presidency. Garfield's death lifted Chester Arthur, scorned as Conkling's puppet with mutton-chop whiskers, into the presidency. The half-breed press poured out its loathing for Arthur, who had stayed incommunicado as the president lay dying. Grant was scandalized by the shameful and villainous manner in which Arthur was slandered as a monster. I know him to be a man of common sense and clear-headed, with good associates, a man of integrity. When Grant attended Garfield's funeral, he followed Chester Arthur in the procession. With Arthur's rise to the presidency, Grant found his influence reinstated at the White House and was instrumental in the appointment of Frederick T. Frelinghuysen as Secretary of State. Arthur seemed receptive to Grant's suggestions and honored him with a dinner in March 1882. That same month, he nominated John Russell Young as Minister to China. Then, without warning, Arthur asserted his independence from Grant and Conkling, becoming a proponent of civil service reform. When he named William E. Chandler as Secretary of the Navy, a man who had staunchly opposed Grant's third term, Grant's relations with Arthur began to unravel. Although Arthur named him to negotiate a commercial treaty with Mexico and Grant accepted, he inwardly seethed that Arthur sought to allay his anger in this way. As Badeau recalled, Grant found in Chester Arthur a bearing more imperious than he thought necessary or appropriate in the new president toward the old. At bottom, Grant's problem with Arthur, as with Garfield, was that he couldn't relinquish his old hold on Washington or accept his diminished authority. The man who had felt so powerless in his early years had acquired a taste for power and refused to quit the high-stakes game of politics. The practical details of Grant's future lay shrouded in uncertainty. He felt the potent lure of New York City and its manifold opportunities, but noted the prohibitive cost of living in the metropolis. Financial worries also beset Julia, who had indulged in a gargantuan shopping spree on the global tour. The Grants had spent the previous winter at the Fifth Avenue Hotel, even though they could scarcely afford this grand establishment. With an income of less than $6,000 per annum, wrote Julia, we found it difficult to meet even the very liberal terms made for us by the proprietor of the Fifth Avenue. Luckily for Grant, wealthy financiers were outraged that their hero lacked the necessary funds for a proper retirement. A group of Wall Street admirers created for Grant a $250,000 presidential retiring fund, which would not only yield $15,000 in annual interest, but reinforce his image as overly beholden to the rich. To supplement his income, Grant returned to his scheme for a Mexican railway system and sketched out his blueprint at a fancy dinner at Delmonico's in Lower Manhattan, organized by his friend Matias Romero, the Mexican minister, and attended by 20 railroad tycoons. For Grant, his vision of a railway network in Mexico dovetailed with his wish to deepen U.S.-Mexican relations. Within a month, he chaired a committee on the subject that included Collis P. Huntington, Grenville Dodge, and Jay Gould, representing leading railway interests. Through Grant's influence, William Waldorf Astor introduced a bill in the New York legislature to incorporate the Mexican Southern Railroad with Grant, Gould, Porfirio Diaz, and Romero among its charter subscribers. Railroads already underway would connect the United States with Mexico City, and the new venture would run additional lines south from the Mexican capital, extending to Central and even South America, along with east-west lines to the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific. In late March 1881, Grant gathered Julia, Buck, and his pretty new bride, Fanny Josephine Chaffee, and Matias Romero, and set out for Mexico to hammer out a contract for the new railroad, whose president he had become. Stopping off in Galveston, Texas, he admitted to a reporter that Jay Gould was a stockholder in the new company, whose roads would radiate northward and intersect with Gould's railway empire. It seems strange that Grant, having been bamboozled by Gould in the Gold Corner scheme of 1869, should have entered into a business venture with him. By year's end, Grant boasted, 50,000 workers would labor on new Mexican railways. Speaking at a Mexico City banquet in late April, he emphasized that his railway proposals would cement relations between the United States and Mexico, which should be the warmest of friends and enjoy the closest commercial relations. By May 11th, he had extracted a concession from the government for the Mexican Southern Railroad and returned home a voluble booster of the project. "The road will be in all about 700 miles long," he told one newspaper, "running from the city of Mexico through Pueblo to the Pacific coast, while another branch runs down to the Gulf." Unfortunately, the railroad fared poorly, encountering numerous delays and setbacks. By the time Grant got home, he could no longer evade the pressing question of where he would settle after 4 years of an unsettled life. Spending the summer in Long Branch, he expanded and refurbished the house to accommodate his grandchildren, then moved to New York City in the fall, where he hoped to engage in some occupation giving me a good income. To have a Manhattan residence was a decision that exposed Grant to the temptations of the Gilded Age metropolis, an atmosphere in which he could easily lose his moral bearings. Even blessed with bountiful gifts from rich benefactors, Grant couldn't afford a New York home, and George Childs spearheaded yet another syndicate of donors who gave Grant $100,000 for a residence. When Childs and Anthony Drexel appeared at the Fifth Avenue Hotel and presented the Grants with this handsome gift, Julia wasn't fazed by their largesse. "So I was to have a beautiful home all my own, and how happy I was all that summer, looking for a house and selecting paper, furniture, etc." The Grants made payment on a spacious four-story brownstone at 3 East 66th Street, only steps from Fifth Avenue, its bay windows jutting out to afford a view of Central Park, with a $98,000 price tag. "It was a much larger and a more expensive house than we had intended, or had the means to buy, but it was so new and sweet and large that this quite outweighed our more prudential scruples," Julia wrote. On September 29, 1881, the Grants occupied the sparsely furnished house, their possessions filtered in piecemeal in the coming weeks, and Fred and Ida and their two children formed part of the household. The new home would be richly furnished, stuffed with trophies collected abroad and assorted items shipped from the Galena house. Handsome parlor books, an old brass bell, wooden sword rack, large black lacquer box, two flower vases of silver bronze and cut glass, as Grant itemized them. He had landed in a world where he was bound to feel poor, but entitled to be rich. In her memoirs, Julia rejoiced at their warm reception at the palaces on Fifth Avenue and commented upon how regally New York entertains. "In our journey around the world, I saw nothing that excelled them in magnificence of elegance." The recipient of two generous gifts, Grant still felt a financial pinch and a trace of bitterness that the presidency had impoverished him, the reason he never expressed remorse about accepting gifts from rich admirers. In his mind, private munificence had compensated him for public sacrifice. In refusing to help a young friend obtain a government post, he made the telling remark that the worst thing that can be done for a young man is to get him a government position. Such places only give a man a mere support while he holds it and unfits him for the battle of life when he is discharged. Unable to retire on a presidential pension and having sacrificed his military pension to enter politics, he discreetly supported efforts to restore him to the retired army roster with the rank and pay of general. This proved a surprisingly hard sell in Congress, especially when the hefty gifts to him were publicized. As the Missouri Senator George Vest remarked, Grant was surrounded by wealthy connections, living luxuriously in the city of New York, and possessed, besides other fortune, of the income from $250,000 donated to him by the public. Perhaps reacting to the monetary drawbacks of government service, Grant's sons had gravitated to the private sector. In 1881, Fred resigned his army commission to become president of a Texas railroad. Jesse, who had married Elizabeth Chapman, joined the produce business with Fred's brother-in-law, Henry H. Honoré, Jr., and soon prospered enough to become a member of the American Yacht Club. At least materially, the most successful offspring was Buck, who had graduated from Exeter, Harvard College, and Columbia Law School, acted as his father's White House secretary, then served as assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. With his broad, handsome face and handlebar mustache, he bore a striking resemblance to his father. So winning was his nature that a White House reporter described him as a modest, retiring lad, as sensitive and kindly as a girl, so sensitive that a cross word was more of a punishment to him than a severe chastisement would be to most boys. Starting with the Comstock Lode, Buck had dabbled in speculative mining ventures, especially after marrying the daughter of the former Colorado Senator Jerome B. Chaffee, who had reaped a fortune in banking and mining stocks. Grant reposed such trust in Buck that he had given him power of attorney and allowed him to handle his investments during his absence abroad. Buck seemed to thrive in the business world. By October 1881, when he was only 29, he became squire of a 200-acre farm in Westchester with a 21-room house and nearly 100 head of horses and cattle. Grant had such implicit faith in Buck's business sagacity that he boasted he was a man of some means, gathered by his own exertions. Grant evinced a trust in all his sons, but especially Buck, who, like his father, seemed incapable of guile. Buck entered into a partnership with a young financier named Ferdinand Ward, and the stout, balding James D. Fish, president of the Marine National Bank. So bold and electrifying were Ward's forays on Wall Street that Buck, who left all business dealings to Ward, imagined he had amassed a $400,000 stake under his tutelage. Ulysses S. Grant had always avoided ethical shortcuts and never lent his prestige to business ventures, denying several efforts to name him president of various mining operations. But swayed by his tender confidence in Buck, on November 1st, 1880, he entered into a partnership with him, Fish, and Ferdinand Ward. Buck added $100,000 to his earlier investment, while Grant and his son Jesse chipped in $50,000 apiece. Grant expected to live comfortably off its income for many years. Later, it turned out that James Fish hadn't contributed a penny in cash to the firm, and Ward had bought his share with worthless securities. In other words, the entire working capital for Grant and Ward came from the Grants, who seemed to have a congenital weakness for confidence men. Before Ward's larceny was over, Fred Grant would contribute nearly $1.5 million of his own money. Amazingly, Grant's many disappointments with business partners and treacherous White House appointees had not sharpened his instinct for fraud. Once again, he would prove an incurably naive man, defeated by his own fundamental decency. Though he allowed his name to be exploited by a business for the first time, Grant engaged in shockingly little study of the operation. He didn't review transactions, leaving that to the supposed wizardry of young Ward. Instead, he functioned as so much high-priced decoration to lure in the carriage trade. One last time, he was touched by a tragic blindness. He never had a lawyer scrutinize the agreement, seemed hazy on its details, and thought he was a limited partner rather than a general partner with full liability if anything went wrong. Grant's Mexican Railway venture was also housed at 2 Wall Street, and the association immeasurably enhanced Ferdinand Ward's stature in the financial district. In trading securities and commodities at Grant and Ward, Ferdinand Ward enjoyed unlimited power. Only he was allowed to sign checks, manage the books, and run the firm, using Grant's name as window dressing. Just 29, but already lionized as the young Napoleon of finance, Ward had fair hair, blue eyes, rosy cheeks, and a charming manner. A pathological narcissist, he had no concern for anyone but himself. Cool and unflappable, he had the psychopath's ability to counterfeit sincerity and present the exact image other people wanted to see. Such was the hypnotic spell he cast that Ohio Senator Alan Thurman had labeled him America's most successful financier and predicted the next president would make a stupendous blunder if he did not make Ferdinand Ward Secretary of the Treasury. Like many greedy personalities, Ward grew up in a threadbare home, steeped in piety in upstate New York, his parents having served as missionaries in India. His father, a strict Presbyterian minister, inveighed against alcohol, gambling, and popery. His mother was a morbidly self-pitying woman who steeled her children against worldly temptations. Ferdy felt stifled by his father's religious dogmatism and the family austerity. After moving to New York City in 1873, he clerked at the produce exchange and learned to trade commodity futures. He married a rich young woman from Brooklyn Heights, whose father was a director of the Marine National Bank, catapulting him into the Tony sphere to which he aspired. When his father-in-law died, Ward became co-executor of his estate and began to bilk his widowed mother-in-law. He also purloined money from the Sunday school of the Church of the Pilgrims, where he acted as treasurer. With four Irish maids, a French chef, and rich artwork displayed in his home, Ward projected an air of bourgeois respectability, and the Grant connection gave him the ideal camouflage for his larceny. When Grant arrived for his first day at Grant and Ward, he pulled up in a carriage, entered the building arm in arm with Buck, and was swallowed up by an enormous throng of well-wishers. He thrust out his hand to greet Ferdinand Ward. "No one can realize the feeling of pride with which I greeted him, not only as a friend but as a partner," Ward said. The young flimflam man studied his famous victim with scientific care, noting that Grant went to church regularly, deplored off-color stories, and largely abstained from alcohol. "He very seldom touched any liquor except ale, and he drank that sparingly and at rare intervals." Ward made sure to have 25 of Grant's favorite cigars ready whenever he stopped by the office. Twice a week, he traveled uptown to join Grant's poker games. "I have known Grant to go to bed with a heavy Havana in his mouth, put out the lights, and continue smoking for a time in the dark," he recalled. "He would never finish this nightcap cigar, but when it was about half done, he would put it somewhere where it might be reached easily in the morning." Ward sized up Grant as a child in business matters, who would never be able to uncover his deceptions. The firm paid Grant $2,000 monthly for living expenses, and Ward funneled extra money to him as needed. Grant associates who invested with Ward walked away with dazzling profits. One friend invested $50,000, disappeared for 6 months on a European vacation, then came home to a whopping $250,000 check. As others reaped 15% to 20% profits per month, a mania to invest with Grant and Ward overtook Wall Street. The stupendous returns dulled investor curiosity about how these exorbitant returns were earned, and dozens of Union veterans poured in money on the strength of Grant's name alone. Going for broke, Ward quizzed Grant about other family members who might like to invest. "He questioned me about the outlying kin, and wherever he found a member of it that had saved up something in a stocking, he sent for it and got it," Grant later said. "In one case, a poor old female relative of mine had scrimped and saved until she had something like $1,000 laid up for the rainy day of old age. Ward took it without a pang." Far from being suspicious, Grant showered gifts upon his marvelous young partner, filling his home with exotic mementos, leopard skins, Japanese swords, hand-painted bamboo screens, culled from his global tour. Ward loved to flash a pocket knife engraved with the letters U.S. Grant, custom-made for the ex-president in Sheffield, England. So intertwined were their lives that Grant even kept a pair of thoroughbred horses in Ward's stables. Grant sternly lectured Ward that if the firm ever engaged in government business, he would terminate the partnership. "I, having been president of the United States, was not willing that my name should be connected at all with any such transactions." When Buck advised Ward to avoid government contracts, He said my father's honor was as dear to him as it was to me. Buck and Fred Grant knew about the supposed government contracts, although their father remained in a state of blissful innocence. Whenever investors quizzed Ward about his mysteriously astronomical profits, he intimated that he had large government contracts for wheat or hay, and hinted at the secret influence of Grant or President Arthur. In this way, Ward purveyed an image of Grant not as an upstanding former president, but as a swindling politician with a hand in procuring government deals. In fact, no government contracts existed, and Ward used these fictitious transactions to extract more loans to feed his bottomless greed. Ferdinand Ward operated what would later be termed a Ponzi scheme, paying off old investors with money from new ones. Violating every principle of sound finance, he piled up staggering debt, using the same securities as collateral for multiple loans. All the while, Grant acted as his unwitting dupe. Ward alone had access to securities in the firm's vault. Every day, Grant arrived punctually at 10 o'clock and enjoyed the firm's success without devoting any time to business details. Either Ward or the chief clerk slapped letters in front of him, which he often signed without bothering to read. He signed one letter implying he knew of speculation in government contracts and sanctioned the use of his name. When James Fish asked how the firm was doing, Grant raved about its success. "I think we have made more money during the past year than any other house in Wall Street, perhaps in the city." He said Ward was the ablest young businessman he ever saw. Fish then asked Grant whether he had ever examined the books of the firm. He said no, he had only looked over the monthly statements, which were satisfactory to him. Grant's complacency was shocking. He seemed to think it perfectly normal that gigantic sums of money should fall from the sky without any effort on his part, even though family and friends had invested their life savings with Grant and Ward on the basis of his involvement. No less gullible was Buck, who had his law office at 2 Wall Street. Ward rebuffed any snooping by Buck into the firm's internal workings. "I was reduced to doing nothing," Buck confessed. "I was sort of a customer of the firm." For those who watched skeptically, there was something disturbingly vague and unreal about Grant and Ward's success. Grant would boast about the extravagant returns, not the way in which they were made. He traveled in a world of Gilded Age financiers who routinely made fortunes in short order and felt himself a lucky newcomer to this privileged class. Although Julia had queasy feelings about Ward, her husband reflexively defended his young partner. "Mother," he advised her, "I'd give anything in this world if our boys were as smart as that young Ward." He told Julia not to worry about setting aside money for their children's future. "Ward is making us all rich, them as well as ourselves." The general who had impressed Abraham Lincoln and vanquished Robert E. Lee was powerless to defend himself before the infinite wiles of a shameless young trickster. As Mark Twain later remarked, "It was the unimpeachable credit and respectability of Grant's name that enabled Fish and Ward to swindle the public. They could not have done it on their own reputations." On May 11, 1883, Hannah Simpson Grant died in New Jersey. She went as quietly as she had lived, having maintained a mostly independent existence and refused to exploit her son's fame. She hadn't been estranged from Ulysses' life, but certainly detached. In advising the pastor at the funeral, Grant said he should speak of her only as a pure-minded, simple-hearted, earnest Methodist Christian. "Make no reference to me. She gained nothing by any position I have filled or honors that may have been paid me. I owe all that I am to her earnest, modest, and sincere piety." On August 30th, the rotund Grant, who had bulked up to 200 pounds, embarked on a 3-week train excursion across the country to celebrate completion of the Northern Pacific Railway. 30 years earlier, as a young officer, he had helped to outfit an expedition to survey the railway. Now he would hammer in the golden spike uniting two wings of the road and lay the cornerstone for the new capital at Bismarck in Dakota Territory. With his continental perspective, Grant had toured virtually every state and territory. No other 19th-century president traveled so widely or glimpsed so much of the country. As his train sped west, he was astonished that every 10 or 15 miles, the spire of another church or schoolhouse pierced the sky. To Nellie, he described the many cities with horse cars, streets lit with gas, daily papers, and large hotels, making it possible to drive from one end of the railroad to the other without camping out a single night. Never again did Grant undertake such an arduous journey. On Christmas Eve, he returned home after midnight from dinner with friends. After alighting from the cab, he turned to give his driver a Christmas tip and stumbled on the icy pavement. He may have fractured his left hip or torn a thigh muscle, and he was confined to bed for several weeks. Days later, pleurisy set in. Headaches flared up. He was troubled by boils and bed sores, and he suffered insomnia. Through it all, he remained stoical and uncomplaining, even as visitors noticed a profound alteration in him. "He had grown very old-looking," recalled General George Stannard, "and his face looked as though some great sorrow had befallen him." By February, he moved about the house on crutches, despite rheumatism in his legs, and felt well enough to grouse that he opposed Chester Arthur's renomination for president, preferring his old stalwart comrade, John Logan. In March 1884, at the behest of doctors, Grant went with Julia to Old Point Comfort, Virginia, hoping warm weather and physical therapy would alleviate his condition. Later in the month, he traveled to Washington, held court at a local hotel, and received a parade of political visitors. When he ventured a surprise visit to the House of Representatives, a recess was called so that members could pump his hand. Still the symbol of North-South reconciliation, he entertained a delegation of black soldiers and sailors and lent his prestige to a new home for disabled Confederate veterans. Though still lame, Grant summoned up the strength to address veterans of the Grand Army of the Republic before heading back to New York City. For all his medical troubles, Grant luxuriated in freedom from financial care. As Badeau recalled, "He told me that in December, for the first time in his life, he had a bank account from which he could draw as freely as he desired, and he liberally dispensed gifts to his children." In this hopeful mood, Grant sketched out in an interview a rosy view of America's future, with the population booming to 100 million and manufacturing surging in the South. He reserved fond words for his adopted city. "New York City will retain her ascendancy over all other places in the country, and I expect the people living at the end of the present century will see New York the financial center of the world." Much of this optimism arose from Grant's continuing delight with Ferdinand Ward, whose wife, Ella, gave birth in March 1884 to a boy named Ferdinand Grant Ward. When a friend warned that Ward's prophets were suspect, Grant didn't care to listen and pooh-poohed such pedestrian caution. "These are able and experienced businessmen who are engaged with Ward. They would not be likely to take part in any foolish scheme." On his journey through life, Grant had survived many toils and snares and been betrayed by false friends, but his innocent belief in people, inherited from Hannah, was now to suffer one final crushing blow. He would have benefited from an atom of his father's cynicism. For 3 months, Ward had secretly raced about town, borrowing money from 4 big trust companies to stave off financial disaster. In this frenetic state, he grew pallid and thin. On Sunday afternoon, May 4th, he unexpectedly visited Grant at East 66th Street and disgorged a woeful tale of how the Marine National Bank had run into trouble and might fail, threatening the $660,000 Grant and Ward held there. To avert this and give the bank time to collect its loans, Ward appealed to Grant to raise $150,000 that would be repaid within 24 hours. "I know the general can borrow it if anyone can," Ward asserted. In reality, Ward was rushing to rescue Grant and Ward itself, which owed $1.3 million to the Marine National Bank, premised on fictitious collateral. Of such knowledge, Grant was as innocent as a child. Still hobbling on crutches, he agreed to see William H. Vanderbilt and plead with him for $150,000. The son of Commodore Vanderbilt and heir to a vast railroad empire, William was a heavyset man with flaring sideburns. Unlike Grant, he paid dutiful attention to business. At first, Grant balked at borrowing from Vanderbilt, afraid he wouldn't be repaid at once. But Ward insisted that Grant would simply be swapping guaranteed checks with Vanderbilt. Grabbing his crutches, Grant escorted Ward and Buck to Vanderbilt's palatial Fifth Avenue residence. Receiving the group in his ornate home, Vanderbilt was startled by their request. He had never done such a thing before, he said, but he revered Grant and handed him a check for $150,000. In exchange, Grant gave him a Grant and Ward check with the proviso that he not cash it for a day or two. With Vanderbilt's check in hand, Ward assured Grant everything was now fine. The former two-term president and hero of the Civil War had been reduced to an errand boy for a young charlatan. When a friend called on him that evening, Grant was in a cheerful mood and invited him to attend a poker game that Tuesday night. "Ward is certainly coming, and the party is made," he declared. The next day, a frantic Ward beseeched Buck to secure another $500,000 loan from William Vanderbilt. "I am very much afraid that the end has come, and that, unless something is done tonight, everything will be over tomorrow. This is our last hope, Buck, so do all you can." New York City had pulled $1 million from its Marine National account, and the bank couldn't call in loans fast enough to cover the withdrawal. Ward had borrowed and written enormous checks on the bank, despite having nothing substantial on deposit there. The Marine National suffered a shortfall of nearly $1 million with the clearinghouse. Armed with a satchel full of cash and securities, which he hoped to use as collateral for a large rescue loan, James D. Fish hastened to the Bank Association, acting like a man dazed with fright. But his desperate move was insufficient to paper over the yawning deficit. On Tuesday, May 6th, when the Marine National Bank closed, angry depositors swarmed outside its padlocked doors, desperate to retrieve their money. As a general partner of Grant and Ward, Fish next made his way to Brooklyn Heights, where Ella Ward told him Ferdy was too tired to see him. Fish brusquely shoved her aside and mounted the stairs, only to discover that Ward had slipped out a basement door. Anticipating the collapse of his scheme, Ward had made over the deed of the house to his wife. Around noon on May 6th, Ulysses S. Grant arrived at 2 Wall Street with the serene confidence of a self-styled millionaire who thought he had reaped fabulous profits from his investment. He found a growing crowd mingling outside in a strange hubbub of excitement. After entering, Grant moved steadily on his crutches toward Ward's office, an unlit cigar in his mouth. In a gesture that must have mystified him, people doffed their hats when they saw him. He was promptly intercepted by Buck, who blurted out, "Father, you had better go home. The bank has failed." Grant was stunned, having had no forewarning of the disaster. When Badeau arrived, he found his shattered patron sitting alone.
"We are all ruined here," Grant announced. "The bank has failed. Mr. Ward cannot be found. The securities are locked up in the safe, and he has the key. No one knows where he is."
A shattered Grant conferred with Roscoe Conkling, looking weary and troubled, a reporter wrote. Grant expected Ward to materialize with a soothing explanation, but the young man had vanished, and Grant took refuge in his upstairs office. He summoned the cashier George Spencer, who brought out ledgers that had recorded Grant and Ward's phantom profits.
"Spencer," Grant asked, grasping his armchair, "how is it that man has deceived us all in this way?"
The cashier could not elucidate for Grant the mystery of human nature.
"I don't see how I can ever trust any human being again," Grant said,
sinking his face in his hands. The whole operation had been a monstrous hoax. As a Marine National Director concluded, the transactions of Grant and Ward constituted the most colossal swindle of the age. Enlightenment came too late for Ulysses S. Grant, who left his Wall Street office for the last time at 2:15 p.m., offering no comment to waiting reporters. "I cannot deny or corroborate the reports, Current," Buck told them. "We are nearly $500,000 short. Our safes are locked, and until we can find Mr. Ward, I cannot say how we stand." It was a damaging admission. Buck and his father lacked access to the firm's own safe, which they had assumed bulged with $1.3 million in blue-chip securities. As unsophisticated in the last analysis as his father, Buck kept reiterating to him that Ferd would come out right yet. He had no doubt he would come out right. When Grant took a streetcar uptown, he ran into his old friend James B. Fry, whom he had invited to his poker party that evening. "We will not have the meeting I fixed for tonight," he informed Fry. "I have bad news."
"Why, General," said Fry, "I hope it is nothing serious."
"Yes," Grant said. "The Marine Bank has failed, or is about to fail. It owes our firm a large amount, and I suppose we are ruined. When I went downtown this morning, I thought I was worth a great deal of money. Now I don't know that I have a dollar, and probably my sons, too, have lost everything."
Grant was correct. He and his three sons had plowed their life savings into the criminal venture. Instead of being worth $1 million, Grant was suddenly worth $80, and Julia, $130. The magical profits had evaporated overnight. In the coming days, as evidence of Ward's giant fraud emerged, Grant discovered that checks he had given to him for deposit in the Marine National Bank had been diverted into Ward's own bank account. Similarly, the rapacious Ward had taken money from Grant for railroad bonds that were never bought, even as Grant's bank books registered punctual dividend payments. The final reckoning revealed the wholesale looting of hapless clients. The firm owed investors $16,792,647, against a paltry $68,174.30 in assets. The day after it went bust, the young Napoleon of finance, in a paroxysm of weeping, hand-wringing hysterics, confessed his sins to Ulysses and Buck Grant. In later testimony, Buck said Ward broke down and admitted he had been a wicked thief and a great rascal who had cheated the Grant family from the outset. Grant then told Ward that the least he could do would be to tell the truth in the matter. Ward promised to do so. Just when he least expected it, the wheel of fortune had thrown Grant back into a forgotten world of hardship, reminiscent of pre-war days. Dazed and stunned, he receded into a defeated solitude. When James Fish confronted Ward, he was far less patient than Grant. "I advised him to go and commit suicide," Fish said. "Drown himself, hang himself." Fish unpacked a string of expletives, cursing Ward as a miserable, dirty reptile, then picked up a chair and threatened to smash it over his head. Ward crouched down on the floor at my feet and held up his hands and whined like a puppy. The Honorable Grant agonized over the $150,000 Grant and Ward had borrowed from William H. Vanderbilt. The day after the firm's failure, he went to Vanderbilt to convey to him title to his East 66th Street house. In a profound act of contrition, the ruined ex-president was ready to transfer his worldly possessions to one of America's richest men. Vanderbilt accepted Grant's East 66th Street residence on condition that the Grants stay there. He also decided that after Grant died, he would take the swords, medals, trophies, and memorabilia Grant had gathered from the Civil War and his round-the-world trip and donate them to the federal government. Grant even deeded to Vanderbilt ownership of his St. Louis property. Meanwhile, the push was renewed in Congress to place Grant on the retired Army list with the rank and pay of General of the Army. For the moment, the Grants were flat broke, and when they paid the domestic help, the checks bounced. By a grim irony, Grant couldn't collect anything from the $250,000 trust fund bestowed upon him by rich businessmen because the money had been invested by Ward in the bonds of a defaulted company.
"We are all paupers now," Grant said bluntly as he and Julia awoke from their highfalutin dream world of riches.
"Imagine the shock to us," wrote Julia, "who thought we were independently wealthy."
The Grants returned to a state of misery they thought they had long ago escaped. Reeling from the shock, Grant succumbed to a murderous rage, recalled former Senator Chaffee. The general would suffer for hours in his large armchair, clutching nervously with his hands at the armrests, driving his fingernails into the hard wood. "One day," he said to me, "Chaffee, I would kill Ward as I would a snake. I believe I should do it too, but I do not wish to be hanged for the killing of such a wretch." Beyond financial hardship, Grant cringed with embarrassment at having been duped by Ward. He avoided society and stopped reading newspapers to spare himself the rage. The business luminaries who had championed Grant now seemed to desert him, and he had to scrounge for basic necessities. Had it not been for the kindness of a stranger and a foreigner, he wouldn't have been able to pay household bills. His trusted Mexican friend, Matias Romero, came and offered a $1,000 loan that Grant rebuffed. In response, Romero simply walked out of the room, leaving the check on the table. Romero estimated that Grant had only $18 left. Out of the blue, a veteran named Charles Wood, manager of a brush factory in upstate New York, sent Grant a $500 check and offered him a $1,000 interest-free loan for a year, renewable if necessary. Grant accepted this charity with everlasting relief. In his note, Wood tipped his hat to Grant by saying the payment was for services ending about April 1865. The ruin was general for the Grant family. Convinced he would be enriched quickly, Fred had borrowed heavily to invest with Ward and now stood $500,000 in debt. His daughter long remembered her father coming home pale and troubled and retiring to an upstairs bedroom with her mother. Her cry of surprise and distress rang out, and then loud questions and quiet replies floated to the hall below, where we children sat, frightened. Creditors foreclosed on their house, forcing them into cheaper lodgings in Morristown, New Jersey. Jesse had deposited all of his savings with Grant and Ward, some the day before the failure, and he too was wiped out. Across the Atlantic, Nellie suffered losses, and not only because she had sacrificed her $12,000 investment with Ward. For 2 years, Grant had been sending her remittances for the children. "When the general became impoverished through the rascality of Ferdinand Ward," wrote one newspaper, "he regretted that his poverty would prevent him from assisting Nellie, who was practically supported by his bounty." Even one of Grant's sisters and a nephew lost their investments in Grant and Ward. Among Grant's children, Buck, who had imagined he was worth $1.7 million, was perhaps the most visible casualty. Hypnotized by Ward's legerdemain, he had invested income from his wife's fortune in the firm and borrowed money from his rich father-in-law that he could never repay. "So confident were we all that Grant and Ward were making piles of money that we invested everything we could get," he told a journalist. After the failure, newspapers reported that Buck had fled to Canada to evade the law. When a reporter went to East 66th Street for confirmation, the stout Julia materialized in a black satin dress, her face flushed, her eyes bright with indignation. "Why should my son go to Canada?" she asked. "Why should he be afraid of being arrested? Why should anybody want to arrest him? Is my son a thief?" Tears stood in her eyes. "You have the thief under arrest," she said bitterly. "The man who has robbed and ruined us." As Grant shrank from the garish glare of unwanted publicity, the humiliation was excruciating. He had been employed as bait to attract victims to Ward's machinations, dealing a savage blow to his renown. "For the love of money," wrote the New York Sun, "the greatest military reputation of our time has been dimmed and degraded by its possessor." Grant was exposed as the same hapless hayseed who had bungled business deals in his early years. One newspaper editorial noted that the imaginary government contracts obtained by Grant and Ward were instrumental in Ward's deceiving gullible investors. "The conclusion is inescapable that a large number of persons were drawn into the maelstrom by a belief that General Grant's influence was used in some highly improper way to the detriment of the government and the benefit of Grant and Ward." Some in the Democratic press called for Grant's criminal prosecution, and even some Republicans saw him as less a victim of fraud than an accomplice. An especially critical perspective issued privately from Sherman, who couldn't resist gloating over Grant's downfall, as if his friend's life were a morality play whose sorry ending he had long foreseen. "Look at Grant now," he wrote. "His experience in the White House poisoned his mind and tempted his family to yearn for that sort of honor." At the same time, there emerged an immense outpouring of sympathy for Grant. He was still America's most famous man, the remarkable general who had won the war for Lincoln, protected the freed slaves, and kept America at peace during his presidency. The Washington Post expressed some of this compassion. "Compared with the distinguished services he has rendered, his faults are not to be considered. If he had possessed a broader but keener aptitude for business, he might never have been duped by a Wall Street adventurer. But the fact of his misfortunes in one direction can never eclipse the brilliancy of his successes in another." The demise of Grant and Ward had widespread repercussions. The stock market plunged, two banks shut down, and seven brokerage houses failed. On May 26th, James Fish was arrested, and when released on bail, tried futilely to shift blame to his partners. Ferdinand Ward, arrested on May 21st, described to a federal grand jury the inner operation of the scheme, telling how he simply borrowed from Peter to pay Paul. He fully exonerated Grant from complicity. "He knew nothing. He took my word. He had the same information the customers had, and he had the same happiness while it lasted." Ward was eager to blame his victims, who had lacked even minimal curiosity and never asked to see the government contracts he allegedly obtained. He was completely cold-hearted about the ruin he had visited upon scores of people. They were so pleased with the show of big profits that they were only too glad to have their apparent winnings pyramided. Incapable of remorse, the delusional Ward maintained until his death that he had sought to protect Grant instead of ruining him. As late as 1910, he said, "I believe General Grant knew that I did not rob the firm, but rather that I did everything in my power to save it from downfall. He was a just man, and no matter how he might have suffered, I believe he was fair in his judgment of me and realized what a burden I had carried along for those years."